Hello, and welcome along to this week's episode of the Total Fertility Podcast, where we explore the minds of experts from all different walks of life. Our aim is to make your fertility journey just that little bit easier. I'm Ed Coates, a consultant gynecologist, a fertility specialist, and co-founder of the website totalfertility.co.uk, where we connect you to all kinds of resources that will inform you, empower you, and help you on your way to finding your fertility. Now, today's episode is the second of a two-parter on sports and exercise, and I'm really chuffed that our guest today is a world expert in this area and has agreed to join us to talk about this in detail. I think sports and exercise is a really important topic, and following on from the Tokyo Games, I felt it was really important to focus on it during the podcast, and I wanted to tackle a topic which I think is often poorly communicated. A lot of patients ask me about it, and they're often uncertain of what they should or shouldn't be doing. As a former athlete myself, I feel very passionate about this area of medicine. I'm really hoping we can get this right for patients. I work closely with patients now around their hormones, their fertility, and pregnancy, and I think there's a lot that we can be doing in this space. And as we heard in the first part of this series on sports and exercise, Ellie Kormis, an international pole vaulter, explained a little bit about her amazing career, but also the struggles she'd had with her own fertility, but also struggling with finding the right information and knowing what was the correct information and what she should or shouldn't be doing. So today we have with us one of the world's leading experts and leading authorities in sports and exercise science. Professor Greg White is well known around the world, but he isn't just a researcher, he also himself was an Olympian, and we're going to hear a little bit more from Greg on that. Greg is currently the Professor of Applied Sports and Exercise Science in Liverpool, and his former roles include Director of Research for the British Olympic Association and Director of Science and Research for the English Institute of Sport. So Greg's held a number of really important positions, and I know, incredibly passionate about this. He's dedicated his entire career to making sure that performance, not just for his patients, but for athletes, is absolutely optimal. So, Greg, it's fantastic that you could join us. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for coming to the podcast. How are you doing?
Absolutely fabulous. Thanks for having me on, Ed. That was a very kind introduction. So, but it's great to be here. Thanks.
Can I kick off, though? Because obviously you're a sportsman yourself, and I mean, you're probably the best person to give us a bit about your background. But can you tell us a bit about your own sporting career and how this led on to all the research that you've done over the years in science and science in sports and exercise?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a long it's a long background given my age. But I was an athlete through the sort of late 70s into the 80s and 90s. At a time when there was no money in sport, absolutely no money at all. I was a modern pentathlete. And I mean, during my athletic career, I was fortunate enough to win world and European medals and become an Olympian. So it was a fabulous career. But because of this sort of absence of money, there was a necessity really to have something else. And that was either work or to study. I took the option to study at a really interesting time, because actually I did an undergraduate degree in sports science, which in the mid-80s, which at the time was a real rarity. There were very few of those available in the country. And interestingly, much like modern pentathlon, sports science was one of those disciplines where when you said you're doing sports science, you had to caveat that with exactly what that was. But I went on from there, and I went to the US and did a master's degree in human performance, which is actually where I sort of started to move perhaps more clinically, as well as in elite performance, but more into clinical populations. I did work around cardiovascular function. And then once returning to the UK, I completed a PhD at St. George's Hospital Medical School, where I was looking at cardiovascular function, so heart function, particularly during exercise. And then, as you just sort of articulated, from that, with my background in sport and academia, I became the first ever director of research for the British Olympic Medical Centre. And I think what's interesting, certainly pertinent to our conversation today, is that was the point at which I really came sort of face to face with the issue of women's health. Particularly based around performance, because you know we deal with an awful lot of issues for elite female athletes, And then on from there into various other areas like fertility and pregnancy, etc.
Yeah, and this is obviously an area we're going to get into. But I mean, over the years, traditionally, it's maybe not always been the most popular area to be researching in. Is that fair to say?
No, absolutely fair to say. I think, you know, there are multiple reasons for that. I think what's interesting is, to some extent, it's only when you really get into it, you suddenly begin to understand that actually research in general, with using women as participants, is light on the ground, shall we say. You know, much of the research work is actually done with males. And I think one of the reasons for that is based broadly around the menstrual cycle, because the issues of hormonal changes throughout the menstrual cycle do have a direct impact on sport and exercise, and I think because of that there's been a reticence or even a fear of undertaking research generally in women. So and I'm talking about the broad sort of breadth of research work in sport and exercise. And equally, what transcends from that is actually the work around exercise and pregnancy, which is really a very new, burgeoning area of interest. But it's very, very new in terms of evidence-based approaches to what should we do, how should we do it, when should we do it during pregnancy.
It's interesting because a lot of patients and people that you'll have worked with, sporting people, will be at the sort of elite, just by the nature of the kind of organisations which you've been involved with, will be at the elite end of sport, of course. But actually, many of the principles, as I understand it, apply to, you know, the average person on the street, like myself. You know, if you go into the details for many of our patients, they may not be elite athletes, but actually, what are some of the things that you've been able to find out which affect your elite athletes that actually, you know, sort of rules that apply to general activity as well for just people who may be doing a moderate amount of exercise? What sort of principles and things do we definitely know, and what do we need to kind of find out more about?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Ed. I mean, the interesting thing is that following on from the British Olympic Medical Centre, I then took the sort of model of elite sports science, sports medicine support, and took it to a clinic in London, if you want to call it the middle ground, so normal people. And actually then that expanded into clinical populations. So I do an awful lot of work around clinical populations for things like heart disease and cancer. And I think that the one thing that we should always remember is that fundamentally humans are humans, and physiology is a spectrum along which we all lie. At one end, when it comes to sport and exercise, at one end of that spectrum is inactivity, those individuals who are fundamentally inactive. At the other end of that spectrum are the elite athletes, the sort of the super physiology, if we like to think of it in that way. Mm-hmm. But all of us reside somewhere on that spectrum. And I think, interestingly, the response to exercise, the response to changes in things like duration, intensity, frequency, the changes depend upon the mode of activity, from things like strength work to high intensity activity to aerobic type work, is very similar, if not exactly the same, irrespective of where you lie along that spectrum. And of course, that also includes pregnancy. And so it's an interesting journey. And certainly what I have done over the past sort of 10 to 12 years now is we're applying what we know about elite athletes into the general population. So, for example, a very good example of that is that in the early days of the British Olympic Medical Centre, we used to have this syndrome, which was called the female athlete triad. Now that's evolved since that time, and it's now actually termed the relative energy deficiency in sport, RED-S, as a syndrome. For two reasons, really. One is actually that the female athlete triad, what we do understand, is actually affects men as well as it affects women. And also is that it is very closely linked to not only, and I guess this is really important when it comes to things like fertility, because it is a lifestyle issue, is that it's not only about excessive exercise, in other words, excessive energy expenditure, but it's also about effectively what we put in our mouth. It's about energy consumption. And what we find with elite endurance athletes is that what they've done is that they've bought into this dogma that lighter is faster. And so what a number of elite endurance athletes try to do is reduce their body weight as much as possible in the belief that they will go faster because they are lighter. And of course, the downstream cascade of that, particularly for women, it does affect men, but for women, is that what you get is you get a significant impact on the hormonal milieu, particularly around things like estrogen. And what that then cascades into is a whole host of other issues around things like bone mineral density, around infection rates and the immune function. and immune function. And so what we know from that model is that actually we can adapt that model into the general population. It gives us a really good insight into the issues of things like weight management and the impact of weight management, whether it is overweight or underweight, on the hormonal milieu. And so therefore the cascade effect of that on things like fertility and pregnancy.
It's definitely well known that, as you say, that from all that research that we now understand a little bit more about those extremes, and actually many patients have said to me over the years, am I doing too much exercise? What should I be doing? And it's really hard, actually, I find, because of course if you're not menstruating, if you don't have periods, and you have huge fluctuations of your weight, then that can be a problem. But actually, as you say, the majority of people aren't at those extremes. They're sort of in that sort of trying to reach that middle ground, that steady state, if you like. And it's without setting sort of firm sort of red lines or drawing lines in the sand, it's quite hard to know sometimes exactly what patients should or shouldn't be doing. Are there any kind of golden rules, as you might like to describe them, that patients should be thinking about? Because as you say, it sounds like it's more of a lifestyle thing, this, and getting the balance right is and not to fear it is what we should be thinking.
I mean, you're absolutely right, Ed. And I think another layer to this is actually about individual responses and also individual approaches, because it fundamentally does matter. I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but where you come from. So what is your current physical activity level? What is your current lifestyle? And, things like body weight, for example, what is your current body weight makes a difference in terms of the prescription that you're giving off the back of that. But I think in general there are a whole host of sort of golden rules around this. But I think that the one real golden rule is about moderation, and it's about trying to reach a moderate volume of physical activity. And when I talk moderate volume, we're talking about things like duration, and intensity, and frequency. So in general, if we think about the CMO guideline, the Chief Medical Officer's guidelines for physical activity for health, then what we're talking about is circa 30 minutes a day on most days of the week of moderate intensity physical activity. Now, of course, you use that sort of language, and actually immediately it becomes very difficult to understand. But moderate intensity is, for example, something like brisk walking. It's the type of intensity where you can continue a conversation. It might be a little bit broken because of an increased ventilation rate, respiratory rate, so you're breathing more. But nonetheless, you can hold a full conversation. If you're working at an intensity where you're simply struggling to hold a conversation, you can only use single words, then you're probably in a domain which is too intense. 30 minutes is a nice figure to aim for, because it actually fits in terms of a lifestyle and our time availability. But also what we do want to do is get as much exposure as we can within that period. That said, what we can do is we can dissect that down into 10-minute episodes. So really, for adaptation, we need 10 minutes worth of activity. So we could do 3 10-minutes across the day. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, and I think we will talk, I'm sure, much about this, but that is the strength exercise that focuses on muscle mass and on strength, is actually really important as part of that program, and particularly important during pregnancy. And the guidelines are for circa 2 episodes of strength exercise each week. Now, on both of these counts, whenever you talk about exercise, the immediate thing that people think is that you've got to wear spandex, you have to belong to a very expensive gym, and you've got to run a marathon or swim across the English Channel. I mean, that is absolutely not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is being more active, moving more is really what we're talking about. And in fact, it doesn't have to be formal exercise. Activities of daily living, things like washing the car, hoovering the house, all of those things are deemed as exercise, because what they do is that they lead to an increase in heart rate, an increase in respiration rate. And so therefore, they all count as part of this process. So it is simply the message, more active, more often, but do keep it at a moderate intensity.
It's interesting what you say there about different types of exercise. Obviously, many of us will focus on the cardiovascular types of exercise, sort of running, cycling, possibly swimming, three very common things people do. But obviously, we have all sorts of people listening to this who may do other things in the gym and that. And is there any sort of data on sort of different types of sort of strength building exercise being better or perhaps worse in terms of the overall outcome in terms of calories you're burning and general fitness and activity levels when you are either trying to conceive or being pregnant, or has that not been ever looked at? Because I mean, I appreciate there's a huge amount of stuff we still don't know, isn't there, in this area, in this domain. But yeah, do we know much about specific exercises around pregnancy, menstrual cycles, and for women?
Yeah, I mean, the answer to that is yes, we do. Although you're absolutely right, I think there is a dearth of evidence. And I think, speaking to what I said earlier, it is a growing area of research evidence, but it still has a very long way to go. Mm. I think what's interesting about a whole variety of those different issues is that, to some extent, variety is the spice of life. But using different types of activity is really very important. So, for example, when we talk about body weight, really what we should be talking about is body composition. So it's the composition of your body is either, we sort of partition it into fat mass or lean mass. And that lean mass, in terms of what we can change, generally tends to be muscle mass. And we know that really what the target is, it's not only about targeting a normal body weight and therefore normal BMI. It's also about trying to reduce fat mass and therefore maintain or improve muscle mass. So to that extent, strength training, so strength-based type work is really very important, because what it can do is, alongside a healthy diet and alongside the aerobic exercise that you're doing concomitant with it, is that what it can do is it can help maintain or improve muscle mass in an environment where you're reducing fat mass. That change in body composition, whilst maintaining a normal body weight and so therefore BMI, that should be the target. And so therefore, what we should be doing is including strength work in our weekly exercise program. And then, yeah, of course, when it comes to physical activity, when it comes to the aerobic type exercise, I mean, generally, all activity is positive. Mm. I think there are small caveats to that. So particularly for men, for example, who cycle excessively, there's some really interesting research work which shows that actually tight lycra shorts and the sort of friction that you get between the short and the saddle leads to excessive heat production around the testes, and that can have an impact on sperm count and sperm motility and mobility, etc. So there are little caveats to that, but generally I think what we need to look at when it comes to fertility and actually during pregnancy is that, and postpartum as well, is that it's the variety which is really important, because what it will then do is give us a global improvement in physical function and a global improvement in quality of life, rather than just targeting a single type of activity.
Hmm. It's really interesting to hear that. And I mean, the more I listen to you, the more I guess I'm feeling more confident and reassured by the fact that actually there isn't so much to fear. I mean, you touched on two things there that I think are the repeated fear of fertility patients, which is this word BMI, and obviously exercise. How do you get the balance right? Can I everyone seems to just be completely obsessed by body mass index, which ultimately is a number, which is calculated from your height and your weight. But as you talk more, you know, more deeply and in detail there, it's actually not just about that number, it's about that composition, which is about more than just doing exercise and burning calories.
And importantly on that, because again, when we talk about weight, we talk about fat mass, for example, it works in both directions. So what we don't want is we don't want too low a fat mass. And certainly the sort of key point there would be around 15% for women. We don't want it to drop below 15%. Equally, we don't want it above 35%. So we have got these sort of lines in the sand that we're aiming for. And I think what's the message has to be very carefully provided that it's not about lighter is better. And so therefore it's not about lower fat mass is better beyond a certain point. So I think, you know, what we're looking for is this middle ground, which from a, you know, BMI perspective, it's sort of 18 to 25. From a fat mass perspective, it's 15% to 35%. And so I think once we've got that information, we've then got a much better idea about the type of activity we should be doing to optimize so that we're sitting in the right zone.
That's really interesting, actually. And I think a lot of people listening to this would be, you know, getting that extra understanding of actually what you're trying to do. When you talk about exercise and activity, it's really useful to have more than just a number and a target on the scales to aim for. And I mean, one of the other things that struck me there listening to you is that a lot of fertility patients, the reason we talk about BMI and the reason we talk about exercise, I suppose, a lot is because female hormones are quite sensitive to these fluctuations. Is it possible to just explain a little bit about why that is?
I think the interesting thing to remember is often because physical activity, stroke exercise, is part of everyday life, I think we sort of tend to assume that it has very little impact on our daily function, but our internal function to some extent. Whereas what we know is that physical activity, exercise, is an incredibly potent stimulus for changes in physiologic function. So some of the things that we obviously can see and feel and routinely measure, things like heart rate, we don't have to do a great deal of exercise to realize that heart rate has risen. Now, as part of that, what's happening is, as well as the rate of the heart beating, what it's also doing is it's contracting more forcefully. And that leads to an increase in the amount of blood that it ejects on every beat. We call that stroke volume. And because it's beating more often, the what's called the cardiac output, the total volume of blood that's being pushed out, is increased. Now, that increase in blood volume, circulating blood volume, will have an impact on things like blood pressure. And we know that blood pressure rises during exercise, not completely normally. But I guess the point here is that we understand and we can feel and we can sense changes in that, in those obvious areas. So things like breathing rate and heart rate. But what you have to just cascade that down and assume that it's having an impact on all sorts of other areas. So, you know, we've done a host of research in a variety of different areas, ranging from things like immune function and looking at circulating immune cells and what impact exercise has on that. And it does have quite a potent impact on that. And of course, it's absolutely by necessity going to have an impact on the hormonal milieu, sort of all of the hormones. You know, we often focus on things like just estrogen, but actually there's a whole host of different hormones that are circulating on a continual basis. And exercise has a potent stimulus on that. And of course, it has an acute stimulus on it. So it will change things immediately, instantly during exercise. But then coming back to what we were talking about earlier, I think probably to some extent, the more important factor is that what it will do is if we have chronic exercise, in other words, we're exercising constantly, it will have an adaptation to that hormonal response. And where the key tipping point is that we need to be careful of is that with excessive exercise comes excessive stress. And what that leads to is what we call a maladaptive state. So instead of it adapting positively and having an improved function, what it can do is it can have a maladaptive state in a negative function. So a great example of that is estrogen. And so in elite athletes, what we find, particularly those that are calorie restricting simultaneous to it, is that reduction in estrogen has a profound impact on things like menstrual cycle. So what we find with elite athletes who are part of this red S group, which we described earlier, is that they can often go from eumenorrhea, so normal menses, mm-hmm. but then move down to things like oligomenorrhea, or actually progress to amenorrhea, mm-hmm. which is, I guess, to some extent, a signal of what's going on underneath the bonnet when it comes to estrogen and other hormones. So I think it's really important to remember that physical activity and exercise is a potent stimulus. And importantly, what we're trying to do is optimize the response, rather than thinking to ourselves, if a little is good, more must be better, which is very rarely true.
And of course, loads of people won't have their hormones impacted on by levels of exercise that we do day to day. Would you say there are any particular times in the menstrual cycle which are better times to train or be doing these types of activities? Or is it just a case of when you feel, go by how your body feels, or are there any sort of research-based sort of studies that have shown that it's better to do strength training at certain times or cardiovascular work at different times because you get more for your more bang for your buck?
More bang for your buck, yeah. I mean, it's a great question, Ed, and there is a whole body of research that's going on around this area, and we were involved in some work back in the 90s looking at cardiac structure and function during the different follicular and luteal cycles, you know, throughout the cycle, and the changes in the hormones associated with that. Some very interesting work around strength. And I think what's interesting now is that we're now taking that work and it's being adopted in elite sport to optimize elite athletes' training. And there are some wonderful apps that are now available. There's a great app that was designed by a colleague of mine's PhD student called the Fitter app, F-I-T-R, the Fitter app, which actually tracks your menstrual cycle and then gives indications to where the best times in the month are to train at specific tasks, as you rightly say, things like strength mm. training versus aerobic versus high intensity interval, etc. So I would say, yes, there is nice evidence to support that. However, what I would say is that in talking about that, we're talking about the 0.001% of the population that fits into that elite athlete model. And I think generally, I think what I would say is that I wouldn't worry, absolutely wouldn't worry about what's going on in terms of those changes in hormones and whether you're going to get a better bang for your buck. I think the best bang for your buck that you will get is to actually keep your physical activity varied and do what you enjoy. So if you wake up on a day and you really think to yourself, you know, I'd love to go for a walk, then go for a walk because you'll get so much more out of it. Remember, this is not just about physical. The critical thing around fertility, for example, is that we know that stress is certainly deleterious to that fertility process, and physical activity is a wonderful moderator of that stress. And the more you can enjoy it, the more impact it will have on reducing stress and anxiety and all those psychological burdens that we have. So I think what I wouldn't do is overcomplicate it with types of activity based upon hormonal changes. I would do what you enjoy and keep the physical activity and exercise varied so it gives you options every time you want to do it.
That's great advice. It's so reassuring as well, I think, for many people listening to this today, that actually don't fear exercise, embrace it, do the things you enjoy. And actually, there's not a great deal of harm you can do if you're not at those extremes, in fact. And actually, it can actually have many positive aspects. There's obviously, as you've already said and touched on, there's lots of you know, there's so much research still to be done and there's lots going on. So let's say our new health secretary gives Greg a couple of million quid tomorrow. What would be the area of research that you're most sort of passionate or interested in, I guess, that you think could help people? I mean, he probably won't give you 2 million quid if we're going to be totally
honest. No, exactly not. I don't think he's got 2 million quid. But.
No, he hasn't. But it'd be really good to just know, you know, where what are the things, you know, if you could have your choice, so, you know, over the next sort of 10, 15 years, what are the really interesting questions we need to know a bit more about?
Well, I think what's interesting is that just generally, I think if when we look at the research that is currently available, I think what we lack is a standardization of that work. So if you look at the what we call the protocols, the type of exercise, how often it's employed, when is it, what's the intensity, all those sort of things, because those protocols vary so much, it's actually very difficult to compare across all of the research. And I think also it's really important to make sure that what we have is we randomize those. I mean, for people who work in science, they'll sort of understand this, but you have to compare and contrast with those people that you are doing something with and those people that you're not doing anything with at all. And is it better than doing nothing at all? So that randomization, I think, we need to do a lot more work in that. I think we need to think about standardizing protocols. And I think as well, we probably should have opened with this, but I think what I'm talking about now is I'm talking about low risk pregnancies. I think we have to be very clear about that. And I think that the higher risk pregnancies, we know even less about when it comes to physical activity. Now, the important caveat to that, I think, is that physical activity and exercise in higher risk pregnancies is still valuable, but what we have to be able to do is make sure that we prescribe it in such a way that we do take into consideration what that complexity is. And so I think if you give me £2 million, I'd probably take a closer look at the higher risk pregnancies, because I think that's where we'll make the greatest gains going forward, so that what we can do is then offer a service to all pregnant women and not just that group of low risk pregnancies.
It's a really exciting area of research and often frustrating, as you know, when you from many perspectives, because we don't have every answer, but that's I think also what makes it exciting, and is that there's so much still to find out in this area, which, you know, will come with sort of the work and of yourself and your PhD students and people within your groups and groups around the world. So it is a really exciting area, I think, with lots of potential. And certainly as that gender gap hopefully narrows and people do grow in confidence with studies. I mean, research budgets around the world are challenged, aren't they? So it is hard, particularly in this area. But no, great advice and lovely to hear you speak so passionately about it. Could you give us your final top tips for someone listening to this then who may be thinking about trying to conceive, maybe have either isn't active or perhaps is just kind of worrying about what they should or shouldn't do going forward? So what are your sort of three golden rules, three top tips to finish on? Because I feel like I've borrowed a lot of your time already today, Greg.
It's been great. I'm loving the discussion. I mean, I think I think lifestyle is so very important. And I think, you know, to some extent, we're sort of indoctrinated with this idea that what the medical and science community can do is just simply give us the answer and just provide it instantly. And I think actually incumbent upon us is to make sure that what we do is we adapt our lifestyles and we adopt a healthy lifestyle. So, you know, fundamentally, exercise and physical activity is one part of this global change in lifestyle. So it runs along things like reducing alcohol consumption, stopping smoking, reducing stress and anxiety, improving recovery, improving sleep, improving gut health, improving our diet. And so all of these things marry together. And add on top of that, I think the important thing to remember about that is that they are not instant fixes. You won't suddenly start exercising and all of a sudden everything will change. You won't suddenly reduce alcohol consumption, everything will change instantly. I think that what we have to think about is much more in the long term. And think about modifying our lifestyles and developing a healthy, much healthier lifestyle. And think about it in the long term. What we want to do is we want to make changes that are sustainable across time. So I think one of my key top tips, I think, would definitely be about think about making sustainable long-term changes to lifestyle. In all of that is obviously physical activity. And I think when it comes to exercise, I think what we need to do is dispel the myth around that and actually start to promote the importance of physical activity. And I think, again, just to reiterate, we are talking about being more active more often. We're not talking about expensive gym memberships, running a marathon. It's just simply about increasing your level of activity. Probably the top tip I give on a regular basis is do more today than you did yesterday. So if you only stood up out of your chair once yesterday, then do it twice today. Yeah. And by delivering to that progressively over time, you will move to a more active lifestyle. And I think my third and final top tip is, I think, you know, it is about, you know, it's about people like you, Ed, and it's about the team, the healthcare team that look after you, is that make sure that you keep in very close contact with your healthcare team. Make sure that they know what you're doing, when you're doing, how you're doing it. And make sure that those paths of communication are in place. And in doing that, what you'll ensure is you get the best advice possible, and you'll be moving in a positive direction. So just keep talking, keep communicating, and think about it in the long term.
Thanks, Greg. It's been fantastic listening to you. You've obviously got such a passion for this subject, and it's so good to kind of not just sort of, you know, try and look across the internet for what might be out there, but to actually speak to someone who's had a whole career researching this area and actually knows, you know, what we actually understand, and can sort of dig really into the detail. And it's, I think, it'd be enormously helpful, this episode, for patients, if only to really reassure people. I've been really reassured listening to you that actually it's about getting the balance. Slow and steady wins the race, you know, and actually not fearing it, not being too daunted by these big things in our lives that we sometimes stop and forget all about when we're focused on things such as fertility treatments or trying to conceive. We change everything, and actually it sounds like it for certainly for many women it should be the opposite. And so thank you, Greg. Really appreciate your time. It's been wonderful. Hopefully we can chat with you again at some point.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It's been a delight.
Well, I feel so lucky to have had someone like Greg White come along and give us such clarity of thought on the really quite broad spectrum area of sports and exercise. It's vast. It affects elite athletes, of course, but actually the principles affect all of us. And many people on that fertility journey will be concerned and thinking about what they should or shouldn't be doing. I get questions about it a lot. And we heard from Ellie there in that first part about how there was actually quite a lot of difficulty she found in finding clear advice around what was evidence-based and what you should be doing. And hearing from Greg there, you know, actually we don't have the best evidence perhaps in some areas. And this has been to a historical gender data gap that's existed for many years in research. Narrowing that gap is what Greg's all about, and he's done an awful lot of work in this area. And it's great to hear such clarity of thought there, because many people give up so much on the road to trying to conceive and have a baby. And actually what Greg's saying there is perhaps exercise isn't your enemy. Perhaps exercise is beneficial, and it's such a nice positive thing to hear. Why give up something that you enjoy if actually it's not detrimental to you? Obviously, there are extremes of everything, and hearing about those extremes of sports where your periods stop or you're not ovulating are really important red flags, and we should all be aware of those things. But actually, really nice to have that big picture view, that holistic view from Greg there, about focusing on the benefits of exercise and how they can actually improve that sort of homeostasis going on in the body. And getting that right is where we're all sort of striving for. So thanks, Greg, for joining us. Very, very lucky to have you on the podcast, and very grateful that you've given up your time. Now, our next and final episode in Sports and Exercise is looking at testing and things that you might like to be doing if you're worried about this area. And we're going to be focusing again on male fertility as we come to the end of our series on sports and exercise. So I'm really looking forward to our final episode in this space before we move into a different phase where we'll be looking about general women's health and individual conditions that are important and relevant when trying to conceive. But thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and I'm so glad that you've come back. And if you've enjoyed this and feel that this could be of benefit to someone you know who is struggling to conceive, please do share it. And of course, if you have time, review us and subscribe, as this will also help with people finding our show. But thanks again. Be kind to yourselves. Take care. And we look forward to having you with us next time.